Okay, so needless to say, this is about a 31, 32-hour trip, and she's holding up. I'm just going to share, I'm kind of like Casey, with my first sponsor gave me, because this is what I know this morning. I'm going to say the set-aside prayer for y'all, and then I'm going to let Carrie take over. Please, God, please help me to set aside everything I think I know about myself, the 12 steps, this book, the meetings, my disease, and you, God, for an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please let me see the truth. That's what I know today. Thank y'all. And here is Carrie.
Hi, I'm Carrie. I'm an alcoholic. I just want to thank you all. I've had a wonderful, wonderful 24 hours. There's nothing like Southern hospitality, and Cajun food served up north is just not Cajun food. Like, I think they just throw some spices on it and say, oh, that's blackened. So I absolutely enjoyed myself, and I've really enjoyed getting to know you guys and talking to people. And, you know, I mean, that's what I like about conferences. Yeah, I get to come up here every once in a while, and I get to give an hour pitch, you know. And that's nice. I mean, I'm an alcoholic. I have an ego, and I'm not going to lie. It's fun, but it's really not why I like to do this. It's not why I like to travel. It's not why I like to go to conferences. Why I like to go to conferences is to see what y'all are doing and what similarities and differences and how we're all applying the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. It heartens me to go somewhere else with a completely different culture, completely, sometimes different languages, going to different countries, and seeing people in the fellowship of the Spirit, that we all apply these principles and we all get similar results. And to me, it helps to reinforce my faith in this program and in this process. Because there are times, I mean, just like anybody else, where I'm sitting here going, do I have to be unselfish again? And I can look back and I can think about all these wonderful experiences when I get to talk to somebody that I have never met before, and we're speaking the same language, we're having the same experience, and we're in this together. So that when I go home and I go back to my life and I have dirty diapers and I have bills to pay and the roads are flooded and I'm stuck at work or whatever little inconveniences that come up, I can remember and I can look back and I can say, it's all going to be all right. It always is and it always will be. It is exactly as it's supposed to be. So coming here and sharing this experience with you helps to carry me through and helps me to believe more. I mean, there's something about the concept of faith and I can understand the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous from an intellectual level, but understanding them intellectually and living them are two very different things. Alcoholics Anonymous is not an intellectual enterprise. If it was about thinking my way through circumstances, problems, alcoholism, I think I would have gotten sober a long time ago. But the fact is that it's not about that at all. It's about absolutely throwing myself into this experience and giving up what it is that I think that I need for myself. And an understanding that what I think that I need and what I think that I want are the very things that are usually going to kill me. You know, and when I give a talk, I like to talk about what it means to be an alcoholic. And the reason why I do that, and I always do that, is because I spent a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous calling myself an alcoholic, and I didn't know what it meant to be an alcoholic. I didn't know the definition of alcoholism. What I knew was that I got in trouble and the people around me were really pissed at me. That's what I knew. I knew that I went to a lot of rehabs, I came out and I drank. And so my perception of Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery was that recovery didn't work because I could not get sober. Excuse me, I'm recovering. I have bronchitis, and so if I cough, excuse me on that one. But and I'm still smoking because, you know, God hasn't removed that one. Anyway, so I thought that it didn't work because I couldn't get it. And I would come into the rooms, I would come into AA, and I would see these happy people, and they seemed to be all right, and I just wasn't. And I couldn't understand why I was not okay. And I couldn't understand why I felt so worthless, less than, and broken. And for me, I mean, I identify myself as an alcoholic, but I am what I am is truly a hopeless alcoholic. And it doesn't mean I'm helpless, it means that I'm hopeless. And what that means to me is that no human power could have restored me to sanity. No human power could have relieved my alcoholism. I tried everything. I mean, I tried absolutely everything that I could do in order to stop drinking, and none of those things worked. I could stop, but I couldn't stay stopped. And what I found was that I'm going to tell you about what my experience in AA was up north. And obviously it's not what you guys have going on down here. I mean, what I hear down here is strong recovery, all 36 principles, the application of the principles in one's life. I hear God, I hear steps, I hear big book, I hear service. But that's not the AA that I grew up in. The AA I grew up in was about sitting in a meeting and making coffee. It was about talking about your problems. It was about whining, what I call lying and crying. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 13 years old. My parents used to drop me off at the front door with a dollar and say, go in that church, and I'll be back in an hour. Because I grew up in a household in which my parents are not alcoholics. They're adult children of alcoholics. I'm one of five children. Four of us have darkened the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm the youngest, and I'm the youngest by 16 years. So while I was a little guy, my brothers and sisters were tearing things up. So my parents went to a place called Al-Anon. Yeah, without Al-Anon, I would not be standing here today. So my parents went to this place called Al-Anon, and they said things like, you know, don't enable them. Make them go to meetings. Make them sign contracts. Don't give her money. Lock her out of the house if she shows up drunk. Put her back in rehab. Don't give in. Live your life. Don't let your alcoholic rule you. And eventually they'll get sober. And that's exactly what happened. So my parents went to Al-Anon. They learned these things. So while my brothers and sisters were enabled, and my brother was bailed out of jail 100 times, they were in and out of rehab, and they got patted on the head and a cookie, I got the tough love. I was really pissed about that for a really long time. I mean, I used to sit in rehab and stew. I'd be like, but my brother John shot heroin for 10 years. Nobody sent him to rehab. You know, gee, what an ungrateful little shit I was. Excuse my language. So my parents would drop me off at Alcoholics Anonymous, send me in the front door. And I would go in. There'd be a bunch of old men. And I would get the Alateenas down the hall, and I'd be like, I'm not here for Alateen. And I would sit in the corner, and I would judge everybody. I would say, okay, I'm not 40 years old. I don't have a penis. I don't belong here. And I'm out the door. And then I discovered that there are young people's meetings, and young people's meetings are great, because young people's meetings are places to pick up guys and get rides to, well, where I used to go, which was Newark. And so I would show up at a young people's meeting, and I would find a victim, preferably who had a car, and I would say, I like you. Would you like to go leave this meeting and get drunk right now? Why, yes. Come on, let's go. So my poor parents, they thought they were doing right by me, and they were, because I was able to come in contact with the program. I was able to come in contact with the fellowship. But I really wasn't getting what was going on here. And I really used it for a long time to get out of trouble. It would be, you know, I would get caught doing something, and I would say, okay, I'll go to rehab again, and I'll go to meetings. And eventually, you know, they'd stop paying attention. They'd stop, you know, watching every move. And the second they did, I was out the door and I ran away and I was doing what I do. So I spent a lot of time around here, a lot of time raising my hand in meetings saying that I was an alcoholic. I didn't really understand what it meant. And what it means to me today and what was explained to me today was that I have a physical allergy, meaning that when I put alcohol in my body, I can't control how much I drink. And that is my personal experience. I got sober at 18. My sobriety date is September 6th, 1994. So I drank for a total of maybe 6 years. I like to say that I was a natural-born alcoholic. And I think that, you know, that aptly describes me, because the first time I picked up a drink, I had a spiritual experience. alcohol. And it wasn't, it was just something so silly. You know, it was Thanksgiving. I was wearing, I remember what I was wearing. I was wearing a velvet jumper, a green velvet jumper. And I must have been like 6 or 7 years old. And my parents thought it would be funny if I drank a little bit of wine. And I drank this wine, and it just burned down my throat, and I felt warm inside. And I remember thinking, I must be grown up because I'm drinking. They must like me because they gave me alcohol. And I can remember the rest of the night kind of going around the table, taking little sips out of everybody's drink. Now, I've done that. I did that through my entire childhood. You know, if somebody put a drink down and run away. And I don't think they really noticed that that was going on because there was so much going on in my family. My brother, my sister, and my other brother were in and out of treatment centers and AA and struggling. So me drinking as a young child, I mean, really kind of got rushed under the rug. In fact, my brother, who is now sober, used to say that what he used to say about my childhood and the way I grew up was that I was really cute until I was 5 and everybody loved me, and then I didn't exist anymore. And with that freedom, because of all this chaos going on in my household, I really had a lot of freedom to do a lot of things. So I got to drink. I got to sneak alcohol. I got to get away with behaviors that were not acceptable for a young child to participate in. And my parents just pulled their, God bless their souls, just pulled their hair out. My mother is a Eucharistic minister, and my dad is an usher in the church. They're pillars of the community. They truly are. They did not deserve the hell spawn that they gave birth to. They really are wonderful people. But I grew up in a house that was violent. And it wasn't violent because my parents were violent people. It was violent because it was full of alcoholics, full of addicts, fighting and brawling. And it was scary and unsafe. And the only time I ever felt safe or any time I felt protected was when I drank. So for me, I didn't see anything abnormal about how I related to alcohol because it was just the way that I saw that other people did it. And when I became old enough to be able to seek it on my own and sneak it on my own, I very much did. And so by the time I was 13, I was showing some serious signs of alcoholism. I had a physical allergy. I had a mental obsession. In the big book, it says that the alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. I didn't see anything weird about the way that I was living my life. I didn't see anything strange about the way. I didn't think it was strange for a 9-year-old to be sneaking Amaretta. I just didn't think that was weird. I mean, everybody else around me did it. You know, I didn't get it. You know, I didn't see the way, I didn't have dreams. I remember when I was real little, like 8 or 9 years old, I think I wanted to be a doctor. By the time I was 12, I wanted to be a drug addict. I really did. I was going to grow up to be a junkie, a drug addict, and I was going to die an early death. And that was my plan for my life. And I didn't have any desire to be anything else. There were times, there were small periods, small windows when I would say, this time I'm going to be a good little girl. But deep down inside, I didn't really believe it. What I aspired to be was a shiftless, useless, disgusting waste of space and to die as early as possible because I could not stand breathing. And that's how I felt about my life. And what my sponsor explained to me, that not being able to stand to breathe, is called a spiritual malady. Now, it manifests for all of us differently, you know, but the root of it is self-centered fear. That I carried around this sense of self-centered fear, this feeling of worthlessness and uselessness, and this absolute terror that you were going to find out that everything that I was or everything I presented to you was a lie. So what I developed was a very steadied and studied sense of I don't care. I was not going to care about you. I was not going to care about what you thought of me. What I was going to do was to do anything to make myself feel better and take away this pain. And if it hurt you, too bad. I deserved it. I deserved to feel this comfort. And it was your fault that I felt this way because nobody could ever possibly love me enough, could give me the sense of approval and acceptance enough for me to feel all right. So I walked around the world with this sense of feeling unloved and unlovable because there was nothing enough for me. I remember my mom, I was a teenager, and she handed me this book. It was called I Hate You, Please Don't Leave Me. I read the title, and I was like, uh-huh, absolutely. I hate you. I don't want you, but I absolutely need you. I need you to give me a sense of self, because without you, without your approval, without you patting me on my head, I'm absolutely nothing. And I walked around feeling like that for as long as I can remember. And I don't know, and I've worked with a lot of women in AA, and I've talked with them, and some of them crossed the line. Some of them were pretty normal drinkers, pretty normal people, you know, had some unmanageability, maybe some fear issues, some problems, and somewhere along their life, they crossed into this line of this point of being of no control, right, where they lost control of the amount they drink once they start. I don't remember ever feeling any of those things. What I remember feeling is terror, comfort, and apathy. That was the progression of my life. So by the time I was 14, I was absolutely apathetic. I didn't care. I didn't even bother going to school anymore. I didn't bother showing up. I didn't bother trying to be nice to my family. I didn't bother with anything that I thought society expected me to do or to be. It didn't work out real well for me, but, you know, that's later on. So I had been in and out of these rooms. I had been in rehab. I had been in treatment. But nobody ever told me what being an alcoholic was. And it wasn't until I was 18 years old, until I got sober, until I read the big book that it was explained to me. And actually knowing that I was hopeless gave me hope. Because it helped me to understand that that it wasn't that I was deficient and that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't work. It was that I didn't know what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was just sitting around the tables talking about my problems and drinking coffee. I didn't understand that there was so much to what Alcoholics Anonymous is. I didn't understand the spiritual principles. I didn't understand the concept or the need to believe in a higher power. I didn't understand these things. I mean, I hated God as much as I hated everyone on the face of the earth, including myself. I felt that it was cruel and unusual for God to have created me to feel that way about myself and you. And so why the hell would I love or trust a God that made me a miserable human being? How am I going to turn to a higher power that created a deficient being like myself? How can I trust that? How can I believe in that? And then I'm told that I have to believe in this power in order to live. I don't even want to live. And I felt completely and utterly desolate, alone, and hopeless in a way that is completely and utterly indescribable, except for Bill says it perfectly in his story when he talks about the bitter morass and self-pity that quicksand stretched around him. He had met his match. Alcohol was his master. By the time I was 14 years old, that was my personal experience. So this went on for a couple years, and it went, you know, and I tried everything. My parents tried everything that they could think of to interject between myself and alcohol. They sent me to live in the country with my sister. You know, and when you take alcohol away from the alcoholic, what happens? Well, they become irritable, restless, and discontent. So I got sent to live in the country when I was 15. And you need a car to get around there. I didn't have a license. So basically I was stuck in the woods with my alcoholic self and no access to alcohol. And during that year that I spent there, one, I eventually did find people who drank like me. But during that year, I had three consecutive suicide attempts. And obviously the three times on the psych ward because of those suicide attempts. I was absolutely miserable. And I just could not see any point anymore and even trying to function as a human being. So in that year, I had this aunt was my guardian angel during my childhood, because it was so violent in my household. I mean, it wasn't abnormal to be thrown down a flight of stairs for the cops to be there. I mean, I've had more broken bones than I'd like to admit through ruckuses that went on in my household. And again, it wasn't my parents who did it. I had older brothers and sisters who were significantly older than me and on drugs and alcohol and not necessarily in their right mind. So I experienced a tremendous amount of violence. And my aunt, who was my mother's sister, used to come in and she used to scoop me up and she used to take me out of there. So I probably would have gotten a hell of a lot more beatings than I did had she not been there. And she would be the one to get in front of me and protect me from blows and things like that, to shield me from as much violence as she could. So while I was living with my sister at 15, and suicidal, homicidal, irritable, restless, and discontent, she died suddenly with she had a stroke. And I cannot even describe the depression and the hatred I had towards God for taking the one person in my life who had ever shown me anything close to unconditional love. And at that point, I stopped even trying in even the smallest way to be a member of my family. And I just gave up. I can remember my mother came up to visit me, and this is something I'm not proud of. I got drunk, we got into a fight, and I hit my mother. That was something we don't do. You don't hit your parents. You don't hit your mother. And I had such rage inside of me that I couldn't see why that was wrong. So what happened was, my poor sister, who I've since made amends to, by the way, and have 12-stepped her son and sent her to Al-Anon. So things are good now. But my sister sent me back to live with my parents. And I had gotten into this private school because the strangest thing is that God has made me incredibly intelligent. My husband calls me an idiot savant. I can't parallel park my car. I have trouble, just with keys and regular doors, you know. Any kind of normal, you know, functioning stuff I cannot do. But I have this crazy brain with basically what you would call a photographic memory. So this year that I spent suicidal, depressed, without alcohol, without enough alcohol, because I couldn't drink every day. I could only get it when I could get it. Ironically, you know, the one place that you could go to get what you needed was school. Because we're all in the woods, all of us. It's a regional school district. I actually live in the same town now. And nobody has a car, but somebody's always bringing something to school. So we'd all smuggle it to school. One of us would break into their parents' liquor cabinet and bring it into school. So I actually went to school. And by virtue of just actually sitting in the classroom and breathing there, some of it kind of through osmosis sunk into my head, and I ended up getting really, really good grades. I don't even know how. So I ended up passing, you know, the ninth grade because I stayed back the year before because I didn't go. And I got into this really good private school. And I came home, and I remember thinking, and I remember talking to my parents saying, you know, Aunt Dot died, and I'm absolutely depressed and devastated, but I don't think she would want me to live like this. And I'm really going to try. This time I'm going to do it. I'm going to try to stay sober. I'm going to go to AA. I'm going to behave myself. I'm going to take this opportunity, and I'm going to live my life. And I'm going to try to do this so that I can make her proud. I lasted 2 months. By the time I was 2 months into this private school, I was in my fifth rehab. And how that happened was very simple. I behaved for a couple weeks. I obsessed about alcohol constantly. I just held on, and I went to meetings, and I obsessed, and I held on, and I held on until one day I was walking down the street, and somebody said, "Hey, Kara, you want to go get a fifth?" "Why, sure. Sounds like a great idea." And by that point, I absolutely knew it was coming. I knew that there was no controlling it. I knew that everything that I had built up, the dreams, the hopes that I had, the wanting to give it one last shot to just try to be a normal person was gone. So what I did was I ate the entire medicine cabinet and died for 2 minutes. My poor mother found me on the floor. And I woke up about a week later in the ICU. And I was pissed because I can't live, I can't drink, I can't die. God doesn't want me. I hate him, and there's nobody on the face of the earth that I can tolerate, including myself. So, naturally, I did what any good alcoholic does. I came out of rehab, and I started drinking right away. And I drank until my mother had me arrested. See, I had this thing, is that I would run away a real lot. I was one of those ones. I was one of those kids. You know, where I just disappear for 2 weeks, my parents wouldn't know where I was, my shrink, my parents, all their friends would be combing the town, and I'd be, you know, staying at some 37-year-old guy's house, because that's what I did. When you're under 18, and you're not legal to buy alcohol, and you're not employable, you do what you can. So I would find some dirty old man to hide out with, who had a car, and was... If he was unscrupulous enough to take me in, so to speak, he was unscrupulous enough to provide me with alcohol as well. So I would find some dirty old man to hide out at his house, and while my poor parents would scour the earth looking for me, thinking I was dead. And one day I came home to break into my parents' house, because that's also what I do. I steal. I lie. I steal. And I hurt those around me. So I went to go break into my parents' house. It was about 9:30 in the morning. My mother's car wasn't there. I hadn't been home in days. And I'm climbing in the living room window, and I have 1 foot over the windowsill, and there's my mother. Apparently, her car was in the shop, and she had the day off from work. So as I'm stuck in the window, she says to me, "You can't come in this house, and you can never come home again unless you're willing to go to rehab." Now, this one, maybe the sixth rehab, seventh, I don't know. I don't know how many psych wards. I don't know how many four-point restraints. At this point, it was just piling up, man. And I said, what any good alcoholic does, F you, I'm going home. I'm getting out of here. You know, so I took my rucksack, you know, which was filled with the clothes that were dirty and smelly in a bottle. And I went to go find whatever dirty old man that I was staying with. And I waited a little while, and I thought, you know, I'm sure she's gone now. Because I'm not bright. I'm not a good alcoholic. You know, you don't get sober at 18 because you're good at being an alcoholic. You get sober at 18 because you're really bad at being an alcoholic. I'm not sneaky. I'm predictable. I'm just completely and utterly tunnel vision, must get money to buy booze now. And if that means breaking into my parents' house the second time, thinking that this time she was not going to be home. So that's what I did. So she comes out of the basement, and this time I'm through the window, standing in the living room. It's funny. So she calls the cops, because this is what she was taught to do. So she calls the police, and the police come, and they say, "You're going to rehab." And I say, "No, I'm not." So they try to grab me, and what I decide to do is I'm going to fight six Bloomfield police officers in my mother's living room. It didn't go over all that well. I did end up in the back of that police car, and I got a police escort to my second to last rehab. They waited till I was on the ward before they left. You know, they were intake, they're standing right in the corner. I did eventually go back and make amends to these officers and thank them for their efforts, because they could have pressed charges and they didn't. And the part of the reason why I've been successful in my life today is because people saw that there was something in me that I could not see in myself. And they were willing to give me the chance. And so these police officers didn't press charges. And I don't have a police record because of that. And I didn't go to juvenile detention. I went to rehab again. And I was in that rehab, and I was able to stay sober for almost a year. I came to meetings. I did 90 dances in 90 days. I made a lot of coffee. I had a couple boyfriends. I hung out. And I thought, you know, this is it. I can do this. You know, I'll do is go to high school, go to meetings, and go to dances, and maybe I'll go bowling. And it'll all be okay. And, you know, the Big Book talks about the boy whistling in the dark. It says that, you know, we whistle to keep up our spirits, but deep down inside, we would give anything to have a couple drinks without impunity. And honestly, the truth is what I wanted more than anything else was to drink. And what I found was that non-conference approved substances helped me not drink. Now, I'm an AA, so as long as I don't drink alcohol, I'm sober, right? So I found that as long as I stayed really high, I didn't have to drink, and I would come in here and lie and say I was sober. I would, you know, talk about the steps that I thought about and I read about in the step book and that maybe I might do one day. And the other thing I discovered was the person with the biggest problem was usually the person who seemed to be, like, the most popular in the meetings. And the thing is that I wasn't going to come in and tell you about what was really going on in my life, that I was suicidal every day, that I had to take substances to keep from drinking every day, that I lied to my family every day, that I stole every day, that I felt like a complete and utter failure, an outcast in society. I would go to school and I would have panic attacks in the bathroom because I could not interact with people without alcohol in my body because it kept me from killing myself and others. I couldn't say that because then you would actually know me. So I made stuff up. I would like watch all my children and stuff, and then I would like come in and I would have a plot line. I would make stuff up and I'd be like, you know, I mean, they all knew. And this is a beautiful thing about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter how screwed up you are, they just smile at you with that stupid smile. And they pat you on the head and they give you that cup of coffee, absolutely knowing that you're completely and utterly insane. And they go, "Isn't she sweet? Maybe one day she'll get it. Let's just be nice to her." And they did. And so, like, here I am. I'm going to these meetings. And these poor, poor people are tolerating my BS and my lying and conniving and manipulating. And they're just smiling. And I'm just hating them. So what I did is I met my husband. He was 25. And when I met him at a meeting. And he said, "I just got off parole." And I thought, my mom's really going to hate him. I'm 17, he's 25. Sounds like a good idea. So what I did was I was already ready to relapse because I had already picked up a new sugar daddy and I was staying at his house. And part of how I pick up a sugar daddy, you guys will love this one, is, again, God forbid I tell the truth. I have to admit, I'm a complete and utter pathological liar. So what I do is I usually create a circumstance in which this person has to take care of me. Because I'm not taking care of myself. I'm not going to be a partner in this relationship. I'm not showing up in any way, shape, or form. But I have to make you care about me enough to tolerate the fact that I'm completely and utterly insane. So what I usually do is blacken my eye. I punch myself in the eye. You know, muss my hair up. And say, "My dad beat me up again. Can you take me in?" And they go, "This poor, sweet girl. Oh, she's in such an abusive household. And, you know, I can't let her go home. Let me take care of her." And then I move in and I kick you out of your bed. And I'm in your bed and I'm eating your food. And then I'm dating other people while I'm living at your house, letting you think that maybe, just maybe, I might sleep with you one day. And eventually they catch on and they throw me out. But it works for a little bit. So I had one of those going on when I met my husband. And of course, what do? I trade up. The guy I was staying with was a 37-year-old biker with two ex-wives and a bunch of kids. So, 25-year-old handsome man off parole. Perfect! So what my husband and I do is we go out and we drink. Because that's what I was looking for. I was looking for somebody to drink with me and take care of me and buy me my alcohol and hold my hair when I vomit and keep me out of trouble. And he was great for that. He was perfect for that. Now, my husband is what you would call, just like myself, a complete and utter hopeless alcoholic. Both of us had been around Alcoholics Anonymous for years and could not get it. So, you know, we were a match made in hell. We drank together. We tortured each other. We fought. We threw things. We vomited everywhere. We were evicted from our apartment. It was awesome. In 3 months, I had a year abstinent from alcohol, controlling my desire for it with non-conference approved substances. I picked up alcohol and when I was 3 weeks after my 18th birthday, and here was my brilliant plan. I was going to go out and drink because I deserved a drink because I'm 18 and all the 18-year-olds go to frat parties. Now, I wanted to go to frat parties too, and I had gone to them when I was in high school, but you know, now that I'm 18, I'm of age to start doing these things, right? It didn't matter that I had dropped out of high school like, you know, a couple months ago. There was no way that there was no plans to go to college. There was no plans to graduate high school, get a GED, or do anything like that. But I deserved to go to frat parties, right? So I was going to go out and I was going to drink this one night, and I was going to come right back to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went out and drank, and I couldn't stop drinking for 4 months. I drank every day. I would leave for an AA meeting, and I would get drunk before I got there. I would pray every day, God, please just help me to stop. Please help me to stop. Please. And I couldn't. I could not stop. And I couldn't blame it on the house. I couldn't blame it on my parents. I couldn't blame it on my brothers and sisters. I couldn't blame it on any of those things, you know, because they weren't there. By that point, they had utterly disowned me. My mother, at one point, had seen me. I was in East Orange, which is a pretty nasty city where I live, doing what I do on the street corner. My mother happened to be driving through town. Her eyes locked with mine. She stopped at a stoplight. And I'm barefoot in a tie-dye T-shirt, hippie skirt, with pink hair in the middle of the ghetto. She looks at me. I look at her. She turns her face and drives on. She didn't even stop because she could not, because she knew I was going to break her heart one more time. At that point, my family would not even say hello to me on the street because they couldn't take the pain that I caused them anymore. So I'm 18 years old, and all I got is my bottle and my alcoholic future husband. So we're evicted from our house and from the apartment because, you know, you have to pay rent. I thought first, last, and security was fine. Like, that's 3 months. Why should I have to pay you rent every month? I'm paid ahead. So we're evicted. We're homeless. I'm living out of a hefty bag, sleeping in other people's basements and couches and things like that. And that's not abnormal for me. But the day that I got sober, and I don't know why I did. I don't know how it did, how it happened. I don't understand in any way, shape, or form why that day God seemed fit to restore me to sanity. I don't know why. I had been begging for it and fighting it for so many years. I could not believe it was possible for it to happen. And at that point, I had just accepted that I was going to die. And I did not expect to live to 21. I just figured I was going to be raped and murdered in, you know, in some alleyway. That was my plan. And those were my expectations. And I crawled out of my husband's ex-girlfriend's basement. And, you know, after a bad run, you know, the bright sunlight would hit your eyes and you just feel like you just died a little bit more inside. And there's all these useful people walking around. They're doing things. They have lives. And you're just standing there with absolutely no purpose, no use, no anything. And you're just, the sun is burning your retinas and you feel like you just can't breathe. I had one of those moments and I was standing there. And the night before, it was my husband's birthday. And we met a bunch of friends to go into New York City. And we happened to meet them at this little park. It's like a town square that happened to be next to this church where there is this 7 o'clock Monday night meeting. And it was absolutely God. I wasn't thinking about going to meetings. I wasn't thinking about Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no plans to ever return to this hellhole. I was just planning to drink until I died, and I was really hoping that was going to be soon. So I showed up at this park to meet my ride to go into Harlem. And all these people are standing outside smoking, and there's this one guy, his name is Billy. And he walked up to me and he said, are you going downstairs? And I said, no, I got $400 in my pocket, a bottle of rum, and I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going downstairs. You can take your AA and shove it. And he smiled at me. He goes, you can come downstairs anytime you want. And I laughed in his face. I was like, I don't think so. And I got in the car. I went to Harlem. I did what I do. And I woke up the next day with the sun burning my retinas and the absolute shame of the person that I was and the person that I felt that I was always going to be. And I thought, maybe I just need to go back to AA for a couple months. I can get some money together. I can get better. I'm sick at this point. I'm yellow. I'm 95 pounds because I'm not eating because food costs money. And I need money to drink. I'm unemployable. I just got fired from my job working at a clothing store because I can't seem to manage to hang clothing on a hanger appropriately. When you're really drunk and you're just... And then people would ask me questions like, where are the jeans? And we sell jeans here? So, yeah, I got fired pretty quickly. The funny thing, though, I was a preschool teacher, too. That's kind of scary, huh? Yeah, that is really scary. But anyway, and a nanny. That's even scarier. But needless to say, I was unemployable. I couldn't even work at the local, Mandy's. And I said, those people in AA were really nice. They're always nice to me. They never threw me out. At least they'll look at me. Because my family won't. And so I went to that meeting and I stole a big book because that's what I do. And I got a sponsor. Now, where I got sober, they don't really work the steps. They do read a lot of the 12 and 12. My sponsor told me to read the first step over and over again until I got it. And it's been my belief, and I was taught, look, most of us have our first step long before we stumble into Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew damn well what I was. I knew damn well that I was an alcoholic. I knew damn well my life was unmanageable. When you get fired because you cannot hang clothes on a hanger, that's called unmanageability, man. When you try to kill yourself and you can't, these are symptoms of unmanageability. No. When you have panic attacks because you can't, when you're in a meeting and you're just trying to get your coffee and walk to the table without spilling your coffee everywhere because you're shaking like a leaf because everybody's looking at you. And you sit down in the back. Did they see me? That's called unmanageability. I was quite aware of the fact that I was a completely unmanageable mess. I was quite aware of the fact that I could not control how much I drank. I was quite aware of the fact that the first drink got me drunk. I knew all those things long before I surrendered to Alcoholics Anonymous. So my sponsor said, read the first step over and over again until you get it. So I did, and 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 I did. And what happened was, she brought me through the steps. And she did it in such a way, and this is something that I've learned, is that a step worth doing is a step worth doing wrong. I'm not a mechanics worshiper in any way, shape, or form because I believe that there's a spirit in the step process, that the principles of the steps, the principles of this program will come to us if we honestly seek it. Now, mind you, I wrote the most lyingest bullshit four-step you have ever seen. It had three columns because I wasn't going to read the text. I was going to follow the picture. So my four-step was what they did, or who they were, what they did, and how they affected me. And then in just a very general way, like an essay on where I was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened in general. So I had an essay on all of these, on selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. and a list of all the people who harmed me. Two very separate things. I didn't connect my selfishness at all with why I was resentful. I was resentful when people done me wrong. And maybe I might have been wrong a little bit myself too, possibly maybe somewhere. And that's about as close to honesty as I got on my first four step, but it was enough in order for me to stay sober. And see, God did me a humongous miracle. I found out when I was 60 days clean that I was pregnant with my first child. And there was something about this, because at this point, I mean, I wasn't willing to believe in a higher power. I wasn't willing to believe in God. I wasn't willing to believe in any of those things. I was willing to possibly try to do this program thing and maybe possibly do these steps things a little bit, you know, if you gave me a Hazleton guide or something. I wasn't willing to believe that there was a power greater than myself. By virtue of getting pregnant, I loved my unborn child more than I loved myself. And for me, that was enough to keep me sober long enough for God to get in. And so basically what happened was for the first 2 years of my recovery, my daughter was my higher power. And I felt completely and utterly unworthy of her in every way. I remember when she was a baby and she was sleeping, I would poke her to make sure she was still breathing because I was absolutely convinced that God was going to take her from me because I didn't deserve to have such a beautiful thing in my life. But I was able to stay sober for almost 2 years before I started to go completely insane. And all of that fear and all of those things, that paranoia, that self-centered fear, the anxiety, the shaking, being unable to look you in the eye, all of those things came roaring back. I had 2 years of sobriety. I was 20 years old. I had a daughter that I had to take care of and, a live-in future husband. And I wanted to drink again more than anything else in the world. And I knew that if I drank, I was going to lose my daughter. That my family had already, I didn't know this, but apparently when I was pregnant with my daughter, my family had a meeting as to who was going to take my kid from me when I started to drink again. They told me this later, thank God they didn't tell me that now, like then. But they did. They had this meeting as to who was going to take care of my child when I started to drink again and ended up back in the institutions. But what happened was, as I stumbled into this meeting, there was a meeting, and it was a big book meeting, and at this point I was living in Staten Island, New York. And there was this guy. His name was Joe. And he looked like if Captain Kangaroo and David Crosby had a love child, this is what this guy looked like. I'm a snot-nosed brat of a 20-year-old. I'm covered in tattoos. You know, I have blue hair. I come into this meeting, and here's Captain Kangaroo telling me about amends. He was talking about amends, and he was talking about how we have to make amends to everyone, and if we haven't made all our amends, it has something to do with whether or not we drink again. And I walked up to him, and I said, you know what, buddy? F you. They harmed me more than I ever harmed them. You don't know what they did. And he smiled at me in that way that I smile at people now when they say those things. With that, I got you. Oh, do I got you. And he smiled at me and he listened to me and I ranted and cursed and did all those things that I do in my wonderful way. And he just laughed and he said, come on over here. I'm going to ask you some questions. I'm like, oh, crap. There's a test. And he said, you know, what happens when you drink? Well, I get drunk. And he asked me things about, well, can you stop? Can you drink one or two? Can you control how much you drink? Can you control and enjoy your drinking? What happens when you're controlling your drinking? Are you enjoying it? What does your mind say about alcohol? Does your mind say to you that you can drink like other people? Does it say this time it'll be different? Or does it say, I just don't care? Yeah, it says all those things. What happens when you're not drinking? Well, I want to die. I want to cease breathing. Oh, he said, well, I got something for you. And he gives me this big book, and he calls this other guy over, and he says, you do what he says. And this person brought me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had my first spiritual experience without alcohol. And I'll tell you what, I can't I can't express the enthusiasm I have for Alcoholics Anonymous or my gratitude. It's hard, you know, I've had people and I've had sponsees who cannot believe the description of the human being that I was before I got into Alcoholics Anonymous and the woman that stands before them. That the two images are completely incongruent. And the mere fact that that is true shows the absolute healing power of God and the 12 steps. Now, I use the word God because I don't have anything better to call it. I mean, good orderly direction, Sam, you know, sure ain't me. You know, for me, God or the word God puts a limit on the power that we can access by virtue of living on a spiritual basis. So my experience with the 12 steps in the program about, or the program, see, I love, you know, these are the misnomers that we have up north. The 12 steps and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 12 steps is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The meetings are the fellowship. The service structures are going on all around us. You know, it's funny how even in my mind I separate these things even though they're completely not true. I mean, the 12 steps is the program. So the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and what it has done for me, the pain and the delusion that I labored under for many years, the desire to die, to stop breathing, to the inability to love anything, those things were ripped out of me. They were absolutely removed. And how that happened was very simple. I became willing to do just about anything anybody said to me. And the things that I heard when I was brought through the 12 steps and when I've been brought through over and over again over the past 17 years, they go contrary to the things that I want or believe about myself. They're difficult pills to swallow, which is why we use the set-aside prayer, because what I think I know about myself and you is going to kill me. My preconceived notions and my prejudices about what I expect from you kill me. I walk around with a list of demands of what you need to be for me to be okay. And I walk around this world because everyone fails. I fail every moment of every day. I fall short constantly. So my expectation for your perfection so I can be okay constantly leaves me in a state of absolute abject terror. Without recognizing and understanding and being willing to have God remove those things from me that put me in that state. So I became willing to seek out a solution. And that's really where the recovery begins. It doesn't begin with recognizing that I'm an alcoholic. It begins with seeking a solution to the problem. Knowing you have a problem and seeking the solution to the problem are two very separate things. And the willingness to seek that solution and the willingness to let go of that which I think I know about myself and being willing to put aside the things that I think work because they don't. That's a very painful and scary process, which is why when you read the 12 and 12 and Bill talks about being the hole in the donut, once you work the steps, the 12 and 12 makes a whole lot of sense. Before, it was just craziness. But now that I work the steps, I'm like, yeah, I get that hole in the donut thing. Oh, my God. Oh, I was supposed to work the steps before I read that book? Whoops. You know, that's why, you know, the big book is our basic text. And the 12 and 12 are Bill's experience on the 12 steps. We have to work them and have the experience with them in order to really understand what they mean. I can't think my way into my second step. I can't think my way into my third step. I have to act contrary to what I know. Because what I know is to drink and to die. And those things are not conducive to living. Obviously, drinking and dying, you know, death being, you know, alcoholic death, insanity, these things. I have to seek some other way of seeing the world. So I became willing to seek the solution. And I became willing to put aside my demands and my rights and my expectations on myself and others, my judgments. You know, and when I took that third step, when I take the third step, when I sit down with the women, well, we get down on our knees because I like to make one of the women I sponsor uncomfortable because my sponsor made me uncomfortable, so we pray on our knees. When I take that third step prayer, and I say to God, I'm willing that you should build with me and do with me as your will. What I'm saying is that basically I've been playing God for my entire life and demanding that other people make me comfortable. What I'm asking you to do is please put me apart, make me a part of your creation. Help me be a part of your game, your plan, because my plan is not working. I'm asking God to relieve me of my difficulties so that I can be a vision of what His healing power can do. So I can be an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I can be example. I can be a beacon of hope. I'm not asking God to remove my difficulties or the bondage of self so that I can be comfortable, so I can sit back and relax and chill. That's not what I'm asking God to do. I'm asking God to do those things so that I can be of service to Him, because I've been of service to myself my entire life, and I have failed utterly. That my life has to be about being a part of something bigger. So when I took that third step prayer, when I take that third step prayer every day, when I kneel with the women I sponsor and we hold hands and we say that prayer together, we're committing ourselves to a life which requires sacrifice. It's the sacrifice of the ego and the sacrifice of self-centeredness. And I try on a daily basis to live as if those things are true. Do I do it perfectly? No. I'm human. But I understand that these are the principles that need to guide my life. And then I had to take a look at the false beliefs I had about myself and others. The fears and delusions that drove me. It says we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate, seemingly without provocation. But at some time in the past, I made a decision based on self that placed me in a position to be hurt. I got a perfect example for that. I dated a lot of men who hit me. Bear with me on this one. I knew they were violent. I usually picked them up when they were like in a bar beating the crap out of people. Most of the time, they were 10 to 15 years older than me. So, you know, usually people are going to go with jailbait, kind of a little bit morally corrupt there, you know. And usually I knew, you know, girls run in packs. So usually I knew a girl that they dated, and I usually saw her have the crap beat out of her, black eyes and things like that. But this time I thought it was going to be different because it was me and I'm special. He's never going to hit me. Look, I have the biggest mouth. I'm the most sarcastic, foul-mouthed little hooligan you will ever meet. It's a miracle that people don't want to deck me 3 times a day. But this time it's going to be different. This time he's not going to beat the living crap out of me. I make a decision based on self that later placed me in a position to be hurt, that keeps me in a state of victimization in which I can look at you and the entire world and say, poor me. My poor little Carrie, she doesn't deserve to be so tortured the way she is. Well, yeah, you know what? I don't. But I'm the dumbass who signs up for it every damn time. And I tell myself it ain't true. So I had to look at all these delusions. I had to look at these relationships. I had to look at my way of looking at the world. And I had to be willing to put those things aside. It says that we look for the unsaleable items in stock and we get rid of them promptly without regret. I can't fool myself into thinking that the way that I look at the world, the fears that I carry around, the self-centeredness, the demand, the me, every moment of every day, is working. I have to be willing to acknowledge the fact that the way that I see the world sucks. It sucks. It talks about it in We Agnostics. It said the God idea worked, our ideas didn't. Now, alcohol beat me into a state of reasonableness so that I was willing to accept the concept or the idea that the way that I view the world sucked. And I had to be willing to get a new way of seeing things. And the new way of seeing things was produced in steps 4 through 9. I was able to see the harm that I caused others. I was able to see the pain that I inflicted on my family and the people who love me. I was able to see the pain that I inflicted on myself time and time again, because of the fear that I carried around with me, the absolute fear that, you know, that I'm never going to have enough. I'm never going to have enough love. I'm never going to be enough, and it's never, ever going to be good enough. And I'll tell you what, I had a 9th grade education when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm working on my master's degree. I graduated summa from my university. I had a 9th grade education. It's not because I'm brilliant. It's because, you know what, when you're not thinking about yourself all the time, you can actually put information in your head. I've had the privilege of sponsoring hundreds of women. My husband and I open our home to alcoholics on a pretty regular basis. We have a house meeting. We've been having a house meeting for the past 15, 16 years now. You know, I get the privilege of speaking all over the world, all over the country, talking about the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason why, and I don't really tell my drunkalogue, but part of what I wanted to do, because I want to kick you guys out of here is what I want to do, and to make sure you run fleeing from the hotel. I'm kidding. In a good mood. But what I wanted to talk about was the absolute healing power of God in AA. And the only way that I can do that is explain who I was, what happened, and what my life is like now. In that most gritty and absolute disgusting detail to the most glorious aspect of my life and the way it is today. I'm a mother with four, I have four children. They've never seen me drink. I get to be their mother in the way that I never thought I was ever, ever going to be. I get to love my family with my absolute heart, with every fiber of my being, and put their care and their needs before my own. Because I was taught the definition of love is putting aside my selfish needs for another person's spiritual growth. I get to have a husband that I've been married to for 13 years and I've been with since I was 17 years old, because God knew better for me what I needed. He was the best, the absolute best love connection I could ever have gotten. So I met this drunken parolee who is 25 years old, 7 years my senior, and we grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we've been together for, it'll be 18 years almost. Can you believe that? It'll be 18 years this May. I'll have been with my husband as long as I've been without him. You know, and we get to share this life together. We get to apply these principles. We get to live Alcoholics Anonymous together. My house is full of it. My daughter has 12-step people without even realizing it. We have a house meeting, and one of my daughter's friend's mothers was in and out of the rooms, and she saw my daughter on the playground one day before I was picking her up for school, and she said to my daughter, she said, "Does your mom and dad still have those meetings? Can anybody come?" And she goes, "Oh, yes. My mom and dad, they read the big book, and anybody can come. You can come anytime you want. Just bring Gabby, and we'll play. And you can hang out with my mommy." My daughter went on her first 12-step call. These are the privileges that I get to have because I paid the price in Alcoholics Anonymous of putting aside my selfishness and my wants and what I thought was best for me, and became willing to be open to the idea that there is something greater than me, and that you all knew better for me than what I knew. You know, it talks about it in the big book. It says that my ideas limit me. My ideas of God limit me. That God wants more for me than I could ever possibly comprehend. And the fact that I don't have it is because I get in my own way. I'm not a rich woman. I don't have status in my community. I'm not famous in any way. I live a life that is beyond my wildest dreams. I get to do things beyond anything. Look, I'm a hoodlum who was arrested in her mother's living room for trying to rob her mother, and fought the police officers and got a police escort to rehab, and I'm standing at the podium talking to you all. Think about that for a minute. Somebody like me doesn't get to do things like that. But this program has provided me with a vehicle and an opportunity to be effective in a way that I never thought I could be. And I'll tell you what, I'm going to wrap up because I talked a lot about what I did to my poor, poor family. Okay, I haven't had a crossword with my mother in 15 years. I have not raised my voice to that woman. I did a little bit in the beginning. We have a wonderful relationship. My father, who we call Froggy, because he's, you know, 76 now, a 76-year-old man, one leg shorter than the other, and he's blind in one eye. He is so incredibly proud of me today. You know, I made up so many lies in order to justify and rationalize the things that I do that they called DIFAS, which is Child Protective Services, on my father. Because, you know, when you do that daddy beats me card one too many times, somebody eventually is going to call the cops. So I got my poor father. They, you know, Child Protective Services show up at my parents' house and they're like, "Yeah, we don't beat Carrie. She's the violent one. She just broke that door." I got the opportunity to make amends for that, for one. But two, I got to actually have a relationship with my father and make up for and be a part of his life. my brothers and sisters. I've been able to be of service to them. I was able to, you know, bring my brother to rehab this last three times that he decided to go. I got to 12-step my nephew, who's now in jail because of his heroin addiction. I got to bring my sister to Al-Anon, which was a beautiful victory on my part. You know, so this program has allowed me to be of service to my family because this is a disease that runs in families in my experience. But beyond that, I got to be able to be a sister and be supportive. I got to be able to be a daughter and be a part of my family. I got to be able to be a mother. I got to be able to be a wife. I get to be able to be a friend. I can be a coworker in a way that I never was capable of being before because breathing was so difficult for me. You know, I get up each morning grateful and looking forward to what life can bring. And for me, that is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is nothing on God's green earth that gave it to me. No amount of therapy, no amount of medication, no amount of, you know, seeking, self-help books. None of those things were able to produce what 12 little steps were able to do. You know, and I was taught that my first step is your 12th step, and your 12th step is my first step. And my 12th step is your first step, and it's this constant cycle. So my job is to carry this message and bring this into the world, to be an example of what God's love and healing power can be to anyone in or outside this program. And what I've found in my experience has been is that there are a lot of women who do that for a period of time, and then we get busy with our lives and we stop. We stop doing these things. We stop carrying this message. We stop being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we drink. You want to know why there are less women in AA than men? Because we get too busy for AA and we go drink. Because our guilt, oh, I'm going to miss a meeting, go to a meeting, and I'm not going to be with my kids. I'm not going to make that soccer game. I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. I got to be there. And then what happens? We stop making meetings. We stop praying and meditating. We stop being of service to God. And we go out and we drink again. And we come back 5, 10 years later. Decimated a mess, lost our children, lost our family. Want to know how the hell it happened again. Well, this is how it happened again. We stop being in the middle of the hurt. We stop being in the middle of that little triangle. The fact is that the women have to do as much as the men. We got to carry this message. We got to carry this big book. And we got to fight. We got to go out there and grab drunks. We got to go out there and shake hands. We got to go out there and put in our time. And I'll walk into a meeting. There are women who have manicured fingers. They got their bikini wax, their hair perfectly highlighted. And they say, well, I'm just too busy to go on a 12-step call. Bullshit! If you get time to get a pedicure, you have time to pick up the phone and pick up a drunk and bring them to a freaking meeting. But the fact is we get so busy being pretty, we forget that this is how we got to be where we are. And my children are a part of the 12 steps. They are a part of what I do. They see me 12 steps. I sit down at my kitchen table, and my son's playing with his trucks, and I'm reading the big book to another woman because I'm helping her save her life. And by doing that, I'm staying alive today. I do this because I don't want to die anymore. And the fact is that I can get so busy, I forget that I have everything that I have in my life because of this program, because I got involved. And I cannot lose that fire. I cannot lose that enthusiasm. I cannot lose that willingness to put my money where my mouth is. And so I got to show up every day. And if that means I have to sponsor 20 women, then I sponsor 20 women until there's another woman who is sober long enough to step up and share the burden with me. And we work together. And so the fact is the reason why there's not a lot of women circuit speakers, why there's not a lot of women big book numbers, why there are more men in Alcoholics Anonymous up where I live than there are women, is because we cop out. And we need to show up. And we need to do our job, which is carry this message and be effective in our lives. I need to do that. And that's why I'm standing here today. And that's why, you know, when I come and speak, I like to put that in there because I want to get the women enthusiastic. I want you to go out there, wrangle those drunks, get thrown up on. It's all right. It cleans off. So what if they ruin your Prada shoes? Buy a new pair. Go to Walmart next time. Don't wear Prada shoes when you go to do a 12-step call, dumbass. But do it. Do not be scared of being an aggressive 12-stepper. because that is what we're here to do. Thank you very much.